Ruthie, and I have a recorder. Tune in Wednesdays from 4 to 5 to Out There. We'll meet people and plants around the streets and paths of Northampton, and we'll think about ways we can share the world. Here on Valley Free Radio, or archived online at weatherbeer.com/out there. Get out if you can. But if you can't get out, tune in. We don't care if they live out. Welcome to Out There. It's Wednesday, just after 4 o'clock.
And I'm splicing together a few things from today's show. Today is actually Wednesday, December 14th. And most of the show is going to be a repeat that I played back in June, maybe. Letters from a Sex Offender is what I called that show. But before I get to that, I have a little piece that I wrote this morning, this winter morning, that I'm going to share with you. It's about something that happened to me in 2002, mostly. Orion and I go way back. When I was a kid, I guess we kind of got to know each other gradually. He's a lot older than me and has always been there for me, but it wasn't till one cold December night as an adult that I really paid attention to him. I had been traveling by passenger rail from the east across the Midwest and the Southwest, heading for the Mexico border. I remember standing downstairs in the train by the door, waiting for the train to stop at Benson, Arizona. It was nighttime, dark. I had never been to Arizona, but I had my folding bike by my side and the address of a city park and a border town where I was supposed to meet my friends. And I had my cape. I think I was the only one getting off at that stop. As the Amtrak conductor and I waited for the train to stop, he inquired politely about my travels. "Oh, I'm going down to Douglas to meet some friends. We ride bikes around with capes on and make up superhero identities for ourselves. And wherever we go, we ask around if there's any way we can help out. And we trust that someone will offer us a place to pitch our tents for the night." "That's cool," he said. "How are you getting to Douglas? It's another 75 miles from here." "Well, I heard there was a shuttle van of some sort that leaves Benson around 10 p.m. Besides, I've got a bike," I said. Just before the train door opened, the conductor opened the glass door marked Emergency Equipment and pulled out a light flare. "Here, take this. You might need it." Then the door opened and I stepped out into the unknown darkness. Just like my superhero friends had said, there was indeed a gas station in Benson where the attendant said that sometimes a shuttle van would pass through, headed for the border. But they weren't sure if it had already passed for the night or not. I went outside and sat on the guardrail, looked at my watch, and wondered how cold it got in southern Arizona in December at night. I saw a payphone and wondered if that could be of any use to me. I browsed the phone book under social services and wondered if I would rather ask for something from people who might reject me or if I would rather try to do an all-night bike trip in the cold and dark in an unknown place. I wondered if my gloves would be warm enough and if the desert sky would have enough stars to light my way. Then I saw a white van passing me by, and I jumped up and waved frantically. The van screeched to a stop, and I squeezed me and my bike in, next to 8 exhausted men who had been worriedly sleeping. When I got in, they seemed slightly uneasy. We got back on the road, the radio turned down low, playing ranchera tunes, and the driver forever looking nervously in the rearview mirror every time headlights would approach us from behind. I assumed the men had their week's paychecks in their pockets from their jobs in Tucson and were headed back home to take it to their families in Mexico. I wished them rest. About an hour into the ride, I saw the driver curse under his breath as he looked in the rearview mirror, and we started slowing down. All the drowsy guys suddenly lifted their heads and looked worried. As soon as we pulled over and came to a stop, La Migra agents were at the door of the van demanding everyone's ID. That is, everyone except for me. The men pulled out cards of some sort to show the agents. Next thing I knew, 2 of the men were getting off the van, and they didn't come back. They were taken from us, just gone. Then the agents closed the door, and those of us remaining kept driving down the road in the dark, but with heavier hearts. When we got to Douglas, -2, we piled out of the van, and most passengers headed for the border crossing as if they did it every weekend. I asked the driver in Spanish, "Do you know where the city park is?" He pointed in a general direction. By this time, it was midnight. I really didn't know where I was, except in a town called Douglas, Country, USA, planet Earth in the Milky Way. I rode in the direction he pointed and sure enough came across the city park. I was excited to reunite with my superhero friends, but I didn't see anyone. I rode around the park in circles for a while as the night temperatures dipped down into the 30s. It was like a dream. We had planned this trip for months, and now no one was here. And I didn't even have a tent because I had arranged to share one with Superloose. Well, the mysteries of life. At least I still had my bike and my sleeping bag, and my light skin and U.S. citizenship, and some body heat left in me. Oh, and an Amtrak flare. I rode around the dark town, perplexed, knowing it was past my bedtime, and just looking for somewhere to sleep. I came across a Catholic church with a sheltered courtyard and a south-facing cement slab that still seemed to harbor some warmth from the day. I lay down my sleeping bag and crawled in. It was a cold night. I tossed and turned, hoping morning would come soon. Every time I opened my eyes to look for the pale signs of daybreak, all I saw was Orion in all his glory, surrounded by a million stars, Orion running across the southern sky. Go back to sleep, Ruthie. Is it morning yet? I took another peek. Nope, there was Orion. He'd only taken one more step since the last time I looked. It was like he was playing red light, green light with me, only he was the most timid sneaker ever. Come on, Orion, you gotta move faster when I'm not looking. I knew when Orion reached the other side of the horizon that the sun would rise and fill the air with golden warmth. They say Orion is a hunter, but I say he is a runner. Maybe in the old days he was a hunter, but now the animal constellations are mostly hunted out, gone extinct by light pollution. So now all I see Orion do is run, but oh, so slowly. Why does he run so slowly? I used to think it was because he was too cold and frozen from the winter air to move any faster. But even though we think of him as a winter constellation, he runs in summer, too. It's just that he runs in the day instead of the night, so northerners don't see him. It occurred to me, just this morning as I was writing this, why he runs so slowly. Orion is one of the brightest constellations we see in the southern sky, clearly visible to the naked eye. But he is not the only star or set of stars out there. In this time, he is the one people notice. But he knows that all the other stars out there are part of the universe, too, just as deserving of kindness and attention, and he doesn't want to leave them behind. That's why he runs so slowly. On that cold December night in Arizona, finally Orion did reach the western edge of the horizon, just as the eastern sky started to get pale with light. The sun rose, and I packed my sleeping bag and rode back to the park where I had looked for my superhero friends the night before. And there, next to a bench, I saw two bicycles and people wearing capes. They saw me, and we rejoiced. Wonder Woman, we're so sorry. We got kicked out of this park, but the city said we could stay in a park on the other side of town. We didn't have any way to let you know. Come with us. We'll show you where. Everyone's there waiting for you. I gave one last glance back to tell Orion thanks for his company through the night, but he had already run halfway around the world. You're listening to Out There. That's just a little piece that I wrote. And so the rest of today's show is here he goes. Thanks for listening.
This show was originally recorded in June of 2016. And in the last 10 minutes of the show, I'll give some updates as to what has happened to the main character in the show in later on in June, July, August, and into September, October, and November. There's been something on my mind I've wanted to address on the show for over a year now, but I've been nervous about my ability to address it with sensitivity to all sides. There's a quote from U.S. Attorney Loretta Lynch from a speech she gave in Mobile, Alabama in April, where she recommends that citizens returning from prison be allowed to exchange their inmate ID card for a state-issued ID card. She says that in order to truly rejoin society, every individual needs to be the one to tell society who they are. A New York Times editorial from May 8th says that her reference to former inmates as citizens was strikingly humanizing. Humanizing. I'm disturbed by how dehumanized people who have committed sex crimes are. About a year ago, I had the opportunity thrown in my face, basically, to have a correspondence with someone who's locked up for sex crimes. This person hopes to be released this year after serving 14 years on a 1.5-year sentence. Yeah, that's right. He's been locked up for 12.5 additional years after completing his 18-month sentence. I knew him for about a year until I found out why, how could this be? Why did this happen? And I'll explain that later on in the show. I'm going to call this person he, but they also sometimes go by she to acknowledge their feminine side. And I'm going to call him Pat. And his last letter that I got from him, the most recent one, just from last week or earlier this week, he's looking forward to his release. He writes, "I can only imagine what it will be like to be out in the free world once again. Being able to do things like go outside any time of day or night, not having a light flashed in my cell every hour at night, being able to take a shower or use the toilet with total privacy, being able to choose to eat whatever meal I want when I want, having a job that pays at least minimum wage, just being able to hug a friend when I want without getting in trouble for it, etc. It's so amazing how much you take for granted until it's gone. Just to be able to wear whatever I want seems like an amazing thing. I just hope and pray this summer will bring my release. I feel like it will, but one step at a time. Hopefully all the hard work I've put in over the past few years will pay off in a big way very soon." That's what Pat says. I'll read more letters from our correspondents over the course of the show. Now I'm going to read some from an article from Psychology Today, the December 2015 edition, from an article entitled "Sympathy for the Deviant" by Jennifer Blyer. Here's an excerpt from that. The author says, "Few crimes elicit as much moral outrage as child sexual abuse. Long shrouded in silence, it began to emerge from the shadows in the 1980s as an increasingly confessional culture spurred survivors to speak out. For the first time, both its prevalence and its adverse effects became apparent. The pendulum of public concern swung hard in the direction of indignation as sexual abuse went from being largely ignored to intensely condemned. A series of sex offender management policies were instituted across the country, mostly in response to a few grisly, sexually motivated child abductions and murders that captured headlines and terrorized parents. Such crimes are exceedingly rare, yet the extreme fear they provoke made it easy for policymakers to create public sex offender registries and pass ever-tightening restrictions on offenders in the hope that these strategies would make children safe. Critics contend that such policies have fueled a mostly unwarranted fear of strangers and obscured the visibility of sexual abuse where it primarily occurs. In 95% of identified cases, at the hands of someone trusted and well-known to the victim." I'll insert here to say that the person that I've been corresponding with, Pat, whose victims were his stepsons. So yeah, so 95% of the time, it's in the hands of someone trusted and well-known, a third of the time by a member of the child's own family. Elizabeth Letourneau, director of the Moore Center for the Prevention of Child Sexual Abuse at Johns Hopkins University, says, "Sex offenders are in fact people all around us. It's very easy to call them monsters, but doing so literally blinds us to when the people in our lives are engaging in inappropriate behaviors." Critics also claim that the safeguards have fueled the misperception that sex offenders are uniquely unstoppable. In reality, recidivism rates for sex offenses are lower than for all other major types of crime, and much lower than commonly believed. The Department of Justice has found that only about 3% of child molesters commit another sex crime within 3 years of being released from prison. And meta-analysis of hundreds of studies has confirmed that once they are detected, most convicted offenders never sexually reoffend. So I think this might lead into a lot of what this article is trying to say about how important it is for sex offenders or likely sex offenders to have support, for them to be able to ask for support without the shame. Because once they can get that support, then there's good chances that they won't commit crimes. Researchers emphasize that pedophilia refers only to an attraction to minors, not to a behavior. Jill Levinson, an associate professor of social work at Barry University in Florida, who treats and studies sex offenders, says, "There are people who have the disorder of pedophilia but do not molest children. I've certainly met people who have resisted acting on these sexual interests because they know it's wrong, they don't want to harm children, and they understand how it will affect their own families and the families of victims." Some studies suggest that pedophilia may have biological origins. And for most sex offenders, the impulse to abuse emerges from a murky tangle of environmental, social, and psychological threads rather than, or in addition to, pedophilia. Levinson points to alcohol abuse as a means of comparison. She says, "We know that not every person convicted of drunk driving meets the criteria for alcoholism. There are people who might have a lapse in judgment or maybe a discrete period in their life where they were using too much alcohol to deal with their problems. The same is true with sex crimes. There are a variety of reasons why they happen, and not all of them are about sexually deviant interests." One of those reasons that she's referring to is that many abusers suffered sexual abuse themselves as children, which can act as a conditioning experience in their sexual development. Others have behavioral regulation problems, and their compulsiveness can extend toward child abuse if the situation prevents itself, even if they're not normally attracted to children. And many, research has shown, have pronounced feelings of humiliation, rejection, inadequacy, fear, guilt, and low self-esteem, and they abuse as a maladaptive way of dealing with their own painful emotions. Letourneau, who's the director at the Child Sexual Abuse Center at Johns Hopkins University, says, "There's often a cascade of negative events. We see this with teachers a lot, where things are going poorly in other areas of life and something causes them to doubt their self-worth. And then they're spending more and more time with kids who have this unqualified adoration and caring for them, and they convince themselves they're falling in love. It doesn't seem to be a preferential attraction. Circumstances arise that are very idiosyncratic to a particular situation." So that's from an article entitled "Sympathy for the Deviant" by Jennifer Bleier from the December 2015 edition of Psychology Today. I might come back to some more readings from that article. But now I'm going to go to some of Pat's letters. You might wonder how a correspondence like this starts. Well, it started, Pat actually wrote Pedal People, the business I'm part of, I think in April of last year. He wrote an introduction letter that said something like, "I'm a convicted sex offender, I'm locked up at Bridgewater, I'm expecting to be released to Western Massachusetts through the Northampton area and next year, and I'm trying to make friends and connections to develop a support network in the LGBT community. Do you have, is there anyone that you know of that would be willing to write me, or any groups or organizations, LGBT organizations, that I could reach out to for support so I'm not so isolated when I get released?" And I wrote him back and I said, "Well, Pedal People is actually like a trash hauling business. We're not like a LGBT organization specifically, but I can try to, you know, I'll look up, I'll try and find resources. I'll ask around and see if anyone wants to write you. I'm happy to, you know, continue to write if it's helpful, though I don't know if it's exactly what you're looking for." And then he wrote back. This is from July of last year, and said, "Dear Ruthie, I want to thank you so much for responding to my letters and the information you provided. I didn't realize that your organization wasn't LGBT. A guy here told me about you, and I thought I'd reach out. I don't have many contacts out there, so the ones you gave me are greatly appreciated. It's hard to find people to talk to, especially from here, who can understand or relate to me or my gender and sexual orientation struggles. Many times I feel very alone, although I'm surrounded by other men. Not too many can truly relate to me, and not too many out there want to associate with someone like me because I committed a sex offense 13 years ago. I can't blame them. Before my crime, I would not want to be around sex offenders, but we are all human. I'm very ashamed of what I did, and I'm not the same person now. I just want to be able to be a contributing member of society and not hurt anyone else again. Anyway, thank you for responding to my letters. It means a lot to me. I'll follow up on some of those contacts and see what happens. You have a good day, and hopefully I'll hear from you again in the near future. I can use all the friends I can get out there, or at least acquaintances. Sincerely. Oh, I should say that I asked Pat if I could share from his letters, and he said, yes, sure, anything you feel like would be helpful for people to understand. Because, of course, when you're writing someone who you perceive to be very different from you, or to have made really different choices from you, you're just like, what led to these circumstances? What led to these decisions? What led to these actions? What was this person thinking, and what had they experienced? And Pat was pretty open about sharing all these things with me. And I, in turn, felt like I could be really open about my life and feel like he's been a support person for me when I've gone through hard times in the last year or two. I guess also people don't do so much handwritten letters to the U.S. Postal Service anymore. But there's plenty of people in jails and prisons around the country, so there's lots of opportunity for snail mail correspondences. In his next letter, Pat says, I'm happy to get your letter. I'm one of those people that has a good heart. I believe I do, anyway. I hurt those I love because I was hurt and I was broken. This may be long and boring, so bear with me. From a young age, I was codependent, starting with my mom. I felt I had to be emotionally connected with someone in order to be someone, to be loved, accepted, adequate, understood. I could not just be me. When my mom started working full-time, I was about 8. My older brother started molesting me. I transferred my codependence to him. I thought it was our special secret, so I never told. This went on until he got his driver's license and new friends. I was about 13, and we drifted apart. I knew I was gay from a young age, but felt it was wrong, so I tried to be straight. I struggled with feeling like a girl in a boy's body, physically male, emotionally female. But no one could understand, so I never talked about it, but always felt so different. I met my first wife when I was 14. We started dating because I thought if I was with a female, I'd have to be straight. I married her when I was 17. We were codependent on each other, and we had 5 children. I was so miserable because no one knew the real me, so I tried church, being a Christian, to cure me of being gay, but it didn't work. When my brother died in 1997, it really affected me, but I didn't talk about it. Raising 5 kids, I had no time. In less than a year, my marriage ended in divorce after 11 years. I got custody of the 5 kids, and I lost my job, and I lost my home, and I had to move from Florida to New Hampshire with 5 children, and then I met and married my second wife. She was convinced that she, with God, could cure me of being gay. And I adopted her 2 sons, and then we decided to homeschool all 7 kids. It was so chaotic for everyone. I abused and neglected my children. I had few resources, didn't make enough money to support a huge family, had few parenting skills, little patience, and was relatively young, 29 years old. My oldest stepson started losing weight and throwing up, and was diagnosed with GERD. And while not life-threatening, it reminded me of my brother's illness and death. So I, in my distorted thinking, then thought I could give my stepsons what they needed, love, acceptance, understanding, since their fathers were not in their lives, and I could get the same from them. I thought sex was love. I molested my stepsons over a 9-month period. I hate what I did to them. I hate what I did to all my children. I was so emotionally broken then, 13 years ago. I was at my breaking point. I was overwhelmed, distorted, in denial. I have one biological daughter who keeps in touch and has forgiven me. My other daughters forgave me, but rarely contact me. I don't blame them. I do love them all, with all my heart. I'm finally at a place where I accept myself for who I am. Gay, transgender, feminine. I finally feel comfortable within my own skin. I wish that I could fix all the pain and suffering I caused for them all, children, stepchildren, ex-wives, family, etc. but being a better person than I was then, focusing on doing what's right and continuing to be a better person is what I can do. I'm hoping to be released in 2016, although I finished my criminal sentence in 2004. I've been civilly committed since 2004. Statistically, sex offenders have a much lower risk of reoffending than any other crime. An incest offender like myself is just under a 4% rate of reoffense. I never committed any other crime in my life. So hopefully 2016 is my year. If not, I'll have to wait another 3 or 4 years to get another chance. It's been tough to make friends because I have a fear of rejection and I don't always feel confident in myself. I'm doing better in this area, but still a work in progress. You ask what it's like to be me. I don't know that I have much of interest to say. I've lived through 2 relationships where I was physically and verbally abused. My first wife was one. Another was a guy in here that I was in a relationship with, and it lasted 2 years. I've been in my current relationship for 8.5 years. If you can find any people for me to correspond with, it would be such a help. For me, at the time of my offense, I was hurting so bad and so much was going on in my life then that I had to shut down my feelings. I had just to survive each day, just to get through, and every night I would feel so horrible and feel like such a failure. I cry every time I think about what my choices, behavior, and crime did to my children, stepsons, family, and how they still carry the scars with them. I'm just grateful that you're willing to extend your friendship. It means a lot. People can change and do change. If you just tuned in, you're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio, WXOJ, 103.3 FM in Northampton. I'm Ruthie Woodring, and I am reading letters from a correspondence that I have with someone who's locked up at Bridgewater for sex crimes that he committed. If you missed the first part of the episode, you can hear archived editions of this, or you will be able to once I put it online. You can hear archived editions of this show and most past shows at weatherbeard.com/out there. Pat says, my biological children suffered so much. PTSD, foster care, adoption, the humiliation of my arrest, that their dad is a sex offender, the abandonment, emotional scars. Their lives were torn apart by my abuse and neglect, and then my arrest for what I did to my stepsons. My 2 victims suffered even more, and all of them carry scars for life because of me and my choices and my behavior, and my inability then to manage my emotional behavior, my lack of parenting skills. I was running from my issues and trying to hide them and failing at everything then. There's not a day that goes by that I don't think about what they all must be going through, even now, 13 years later. I have to live with this for life, knowing I caused so much pain is what will keep me from doing anything that will hurt anyone else.
So I'm going to play a song. This is Forgiveness by Toby Mac.
'Cause we all make mistakes sometimes, and we all step across that line, but nothing's sweeter than the day we find, we find. It's hanging over him like the clouds of Seattle. It raining on his swag, falling deeper in the saddle. It's written on his face, he don't have to speak a sound. Somebody call the 5-0, we got a man down. Now you can go and play like you're all rock and roll, but guilt does a job on each and every man's soul. And when your head hits the pillow at the nightfall, you can bet your life that it's gonna be a fight, y'all. 'Cause we all make mistakes sometimes, and we've all stepped across that line, but nothing's sweeter than the nightfall, you can bet your life.
That was Toby Mac with Forgiveness. You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio, WXOJLP 103.3 FM. I'm Ruthie Woodring. I've been playing, talking about people who have committed sex crimes, and a friend of mine that I've been writing for the last year who's at Bridgewater locked up, and I'm just going to go back to that.
For my next letter from Pat from October of 2015. Hi, Ruthie. It's good to hear from you again, and you're most welcome for my sharing. In fact, don't be afraid to ask me anything that comes to mind. I'll answer as best I can. Being open and honest is a part of me healing and being a better person. Pat goes on to talk about his boyfriend of the last 8.5 years there at Bridgewater and some of the things about how it is the daily life there in jail. In one of my letters, I mentioned to him some anecdote about trying to hitchhike through Tennessee to get home to my parents' place. And he says, "It's funny, it may sound crazy, but I've always been scared to hitchhike. I always feared being attacked." Now I'm going to go back to the article from the December edition of Psychology Today, Sympathy for the Deviant by Jennifer Blyer. In this article, they look into detail in this one man's situation. I'll call him Eugene, who sexually molested some teenage boys when he was in his 60s, and then he got arrested for it. It says, the only silver lining after his arrest was that he finally felt free to open up. He saw a clinical psychologist for 6 months, during which time he came to realize that while he still loved his wife, they had grown apart to the point of leading parallel lives, leaving him emotionally adrift. He says, in my 6 months of counseling, I was only afforded time to scratch the surface, but it was very helpful. I wish I'd known even a small part of what I learned during that time before I did what I did. Jill Levinson, an associate professor of social work at Barry University in Florida, who treats and studies sex offenders, says that while there are countless routes to sexual offending, and the majority of men with low self-worth are certainly not destined to become child molesters, there's often a common denominator in men who feel fundamentally bad about themselves and go on to develop close emotional connections with minors. She says, many don't have very good avenues for self-esteem, and they seem to fall in love with a particular child who makes them feel special and important and doesn't have the same kinds of expectations and judgments an adult would. She says, I'm not excusing or condoning it, but it's important to realize that the pathway is really similar to the way the rest of us experience relationships. It's about emotional intimacy that gets sexualized. Most offenders are stopped only after they've careened all the way down that path and children have been harmed. The challenge from a prevention perspective is both to recognize that arriving at that point is not inevitable and to offer secure off-ramps before they get there. Charles Flinton, a forensic psychologist in San Francisco who provides court-mandated therapy to sex offenders and conducts evaluations to determine their risk status, he says, things don't just happen. It builds up over time. Let's say somebody finds himself sexually attracted to children. He may start by looking at magazines or catalogs with kids in bathing suits. He's a little nervous, and then he becomes desensitized to that nervousness. He may start creating arguments in his head that it's okay to put himself in situations with kids or to prepare children to be more comfortable around him in what would otherwise be awkward situations. With each step, he moves toward offense behavior. Most are able to identify a point at which there's a fork in the road. The author goes on to say, but unlike other kinds of risky behavior, however, the secret nature of their attraction leaves no opportunity for intervention, let alone empathy for whatever internal struggle they may be engaged in to control themselves. What's more, the profound stigma that surrounds sexual attraction to children actually ends up abetting the very behavior it stigmatizes, amounting to a catch-22 with abhorrent consequences. Flinton, the forensic psychologist from San Francisco, says, people with a sexual interest in children don't have any reality check to bounce up against. We engage in sexual decision-making, as with any decision-making, by communicating and interacting with others about our dilemmas. But these people are totally isolated, which only increases their risk of acting out. They become entrenched in a double life that's hard to escape. Joan Tabachnik, the co-chair of the Prevention Committee of the Association for the Treatment of Sexual Abusers, says that the isolation is ultimately more dangerous than the feelings themselves. She says sex abuse thrives in isolation, and shame sets the isolation in concrete. If we can begin to break apart that shame and isolation, will be much more likely to intervene earlier in the cycle. The environment that allows sex abuse to thrive will be eroded. My correspondence with Pat emphasizes a lot of that about the isolation. In Pat's letters, you can hear he's constantly trying to reach out, make friends, because he knows once he's released, he can't isolate. Because if he goes down that path of isolation, it's not going to be good. So he's pushing himself to connect with people and reach out and have some of those relationships in place when he gets released. When I first started writing Pat, and he asked me if I knew of anyone else that wanted to write him, I asked some friends, a handful of friends, but everyone I asked was too busy or not interested. And I did feel like I was asking them to do this special, dirty, stigmatized thing. And it kind of hurt. Like, people were afraid just to write letters to someone who was locked up. I don't know that people were afraid. There just wasn't much motivation, which, you know, I can understand in terms of how many people do you know that carry on regular correspondence, written correspondence through the mail with anybody, really? So whether or not I was asking them to write someone who is a convicted sex offender or write a letter, carry a correspondence with anyone locked up for anything, or just a pen pal, period, who's to say? Going back to the article from Psychology Today, the author says, the dense mass of stigma surrounding sexual abuse not only deflects compassion for potential abusers, but it erects particular barriers that prevent them from getting help. Levinson surveyed convicted offenders about these barriers, and she says, the first thing they say is that they really had no idea where to go. They see all these public health announcements, if you have a drug problem or a gambling problem or you think you have HIV, call this number, but you never see a bus go by with an ad that says, if you're concerned about your attractions to children, call this number. Another barrier they have is the very shame and fear of judgment. Like, they think, if I open up and tell somebody, what are they going to think of me? People attracted to juveniles also internalize the message that they can't be cured. Levinson says, when they open a newspaper or turn on the TV, they hear the same message that you and I do, that sex offenders are monsters who will always reoffend. She says, are there people who are attracted to kids? Yes. Can we change that attraction? For some, no, although they can choose not to act on it. But if somebody believes he can't be cured, he's not going to ask for help. Another obstacle cited by sex offenders is the very real fear of legal consequences. Mandatory reporting legislation requires certain licensed professionals, including doctors, teachers, psychotherapists, and social workers, to report suspected cases of child abuse or neglect to child welfare authorities. The laws are federally mandated, and although they differ somewhat among jurisdictions, the intent and requirement are the same everywhere and have a clearly good purpose, to protect children from harm. In many states, the failure to report is a misdemeanor punishable by imprisonment and fines. Mandatory reporting laws are credited with facilitating a decrease in all kinds of abuse and neglect over the past several decades. In the case of sexual abuse, however, they've had the inadvertent effect of making it very hard for someone who is attracted to children and who may even be inching along the pathway toward abuse by looking at child pornography, for instance, or touching a kid's thigh to ask for help without risking the infamy of being identified. Levinson says, self-preservation steps in. Even if they've never acted on them, men who are concerned about their attractions are reluctant to seek counseling because they're afraid they're going to be reported. Even admissions that fall within the limits of confidentiality in psychological treatment are seldom voiced because of confusion and fear. Levinson says, if someone comes in and says, I've been looking at pictures of children in bathing suits in a Macy's catalog, that's not usually something that would have to be reported. But the actual details about what requires a report, in many states, an identifiable child has to be endangered, tend to be overlooked within the overall climate of vilification and punishment. She says, people are terrified to admit to anything, whether or not their admission would really necessitate a report. There are absolutely people who have started down the road of offending who want to stop, Letourneau says. They don't get help because between mandatory reporting and lifetime sex offender registration, the consequences are too much to bear. So I'm going to talk a little bit more about Pat's case, Pat's situation, and read some more from what he's told me in his letters. Pat says about his why he did what he did. He says, I believe you have to understand that sex offenses are usually due to underlying issues that were never dealt with, and something triggers the process. I convinced myself I was sharing love because that's what I wanted to get from them, from my stepsons. I didn't want to face what I was really doing to them. I didn't want to think about consequences and my distorted thinking because my brother did it to me at their age, and I had felt then that it was love, acceptance, and understanding. And because my stepsons accepted me and didn't judge me and didn't reject me, it was okay. That was totally distorted thinking. I was so scared of rejection because my male peers rejected me all the time. I convinced myself it was love to justify what I was doing. I wanted it to be true then because I was desperate to feel love, accepted, understood for me, the real me. They had a sense of maleness and self-confidence that I never had, and I convinced myself I could somehow gain that from them through trying to sexually please them, which is totally ridiculous. But I was such a mess then that I convinced myself of it. When I sexually abused my stepsons, I was in a real sense trying to have my brother back, my brother who had died, who had sexually abused me. Pat has explained to me that it was really complicated, his brother's sexual abuse, because it was abuse and it was wrong, but at the same time, he felt accepted and loved by his older brother. So when he sexually abused his stepsons, he wanted that feeling back, where he was carefree, loved, accepted, and understood, where he had that special place, which is what Pat says, it's what I thought I had with my brother. What he said was our own special secret. Again, in my mind then, I wanted love and acceptance and understanding so bad, I didn't care about future consequences, only feeling better in those moments. I truly believe that had I opened up to someone about my issues, I would not have isolated to avoid rejection and ridicule. I would not have run from or tried to hide my problems. I wouldn't have been lonely or tried to be someone I wasn't. And I wouldn't have abused and neglected my children or sexually abused my stepsons. When we try to hide or avoid problems or try to force ourselves to be who we're not, we can hurt the innocent, the ones we love, and create more problems. I'd advise anyone facing similar situations, first, be honest with yourself. Reach out to family, friends, get help, and think about how your choices affect everyone around you, not just you. In terms of statistics about sex offenders and the low recidivism rates of sex offenders relative to other crimes, with any statistics, there's so many variables. The bottom line is everyone is human and is capable of horrible acts given the right circumstances, but is equally capable of change and doing good, loving, caring things. I would never have thought I would be capable of what I did, but I did it. I was never sexually attracted to children or boys in general, only to my stepsons, and only because I developed an inappropriate emotional identification with them. Then Pat goes on to talk about being gay and self-acceptance. He says, I was never able to admit being gay, but now it's just who I am. It's been a struggle getting comfortable in my own skin. Some days I feel really unclear of who I am in terms of normal, because it was so ingrained in me that male and female were so distinctly separate, and one had to be either or, if that makes sense. Society loves to portray people as bad or good, or label them alcoholic, drug addict, sex offender, felon, etc. I just wish they would see that people are people. What we do is not always a reflection of who we are. At one time, I was a good, loving father. Most wouldn't believe that based on what I did. But if someone gets to know the person I am now, they would hopefully see the good in my heart, and hopefully some people will take that chance and get to know me, like you have. If you just tuned in, you're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio, and also streaming online at valleyfreeradio.org. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. I've been talking about people who have committed sex offenses, and I've been reading excerpts from a correspondence I have with someone who's locked up in Bridgewater State Prison in Eastern Mass. Actually, he completed his sentence, his 1.5-year sentence as a sex offender 12 years ago, but he's still locked up because of the civil commitment laws in Massachusetts.
And I'm going to skip ahead to some. I got to skip some stuff in this show because I'm running short on time. Sorry if it's a little bit disjointed. Okay. You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio.
Say a few things about Pat's crime and sentence. He said he was sentenced to 2.5 years for indecent assault. It was his first conviction. He had no record of violent crime or no other convictions. And he told me that after he did his time, I think he did 1.5 years on that sentence in the county jail. And then after he did his time, when he was going to be released in Massachusetts, well, he had lived in Texas with his family for a few months or part of the time that he was abusing his stepsons. And so when the state, or when Massachusetts was going to release him, the state of Texas said, if he's released up there, we're going to bring charges against him in Texas. So he had his family hired a lawyer that wasn't very helpful, especially because his family ran out of money to pay the lawyer. But his options were to be civilly committed and go to Bridgewater in Eastern Mass, or to be released and face charges from Texas. And he was like, well, I don't want to go to prison in Texas. I'd rather stay in Massachusetts near my family. And the lawyer recommended that he take the civil commitment charge and go to Bridgewater. And then the lawyer would work on getting him, you know, filing to get him released from Bridgewater. What Pat has told me is that if you're civilly committed, legally, you're supposed to be able to file, I think it's called a Section 9, once a year for your release. But because of the backlog, in reality, people don't have a chance for that Section 9 to be heard before judge. More, it's more like once every 3 or 4 years instead of once a year. Anyway, so then he went to Bridgewater, and then his family ran out of money, the lawyer dropped out of the picture, and he didn't file a Section 9 on his own or with a public defender because he was like, well, I'm not going to file to get released here because they're just going to lock me up in Texas. And so he had that hanging over his head for 10 years is what he told me. For 10 years, he just accepted that civil commitment at Bridgewater. And then after about 10 years, he got notified by the state of Texas that they were dropping the charges, that they weren't going to prosecute because the statute of limitations had run out, I think. So then he got a lawyer and filed a Section 9 to be released. And I think that was about 3 or 4 years ago. And now this year, he's finally getting his day in court and hopes to be released this summer or fall. There's a whole other thing with about the process of how someone is civilly committed. The state has a couple of QEs, qualifying examiners, that try and decide whether or not they think you're a risk to society. And that's a whole other legal process. I'm going to read a little bit more about from, this is from one of Pat's letters. It's a crazy law, civil commitments, because it's based on future offenses if one is considered likely to reoffend. And that's nearly impossible to predict with any level of accuracy.
Actually, I'm going to interrupt this and skip ahead a little bit more because I'm just looking at the time.
He's been there for about 12 years. He was civilly committed about 12 years ago after completing his sentence of 1.5 to 2.5 years for indecent sexual assault. So I'm going to wrap up this edition of Out There soon. I just wanted to close with a couple more things from the article from Psychology Today, the December 2015 edition. The article entitled Sympathy for the Deviant by Jennifer Blyer. The author says that some mental health professionals are fuzzy about their own legal obligations, like when it comes to mandatory reporting and stuff, and they're nervous about their liability, and they've been known to shirk potential clients who want therapy. Charles Flinton, a forensic psychologist in San Francisco, says, a lot of sex offenders I've worked with knew they had a problem before they acted out illegally. They sought assistance and were turned down. He says, therapists reject them, saying, I can't work with you, or you can't tell me this. It's infuriating, really, because a crime could have been prevented and these guys could have ended up living productive lives. In recent years, Flinton has himself been contacted by more and more men in this position. He says, they call me and tell me, I'm having sexual fantasies about children. I don't want to. What do I do? Or it's often their wife or girlfriend who calls out of concern. They say their partner isn't really present, that he's missing a lot of family time or spending hours a day looking at pornography and seems to be building a double life. In 2013, Flinton opened a Bay Area clinic called the Blue Rock Institute. Although the clinic has received only about 100 clients so far, it represents a hopeful example of what proactive prevention of sexual abuse could look like. While vigilant about making mandated reports when required, the clinic primarily reaches men who describe deviant fantasies but who haven't yet crossed the line of illegal behavior. The treatment model is very similar to interventions for addiction. As with substance abuse, Flinton explains, sexually abusive behavior is often something people engage in to suppress negative feelings. The clinic's therapeutic focus is on addressing the underlying source of those feelings. many times in family dynamics or early traumatic experiences, as well as on helping people work past their shame, comprehend how distorted thought patterns can reinforce unhealthy sexual behavior, and learn how to meet their needs in healthy ways. Clinton says, we want these guys feeling safe to look at themselves and understand their problem. They often have a lot of internal strengths. It's about identifying those and capitalizing on them while still holding the men accountable. Our goal is to prevent victims. You have to get these guys in the door to be able to do that. Like Pat, the person I've been corresponding with and whose letters I've been reading from today, the main character of this article, or the case study person, Eugene, says, I take full responsibility for my actions. Yes, I'm a sex offender. I'll live with this for the rest of my life. But surely it must be possible to construct some sort of framework of help for men like me that doesn't end with victims in prison. And like I said earlier in the show, people who commit sex offenses are all around us. Some people are arrested and go to jail. The line between people doing inappropriate things sexually and getting labeled a sex offender, getting locked up, it can be really blurry. But we all live together. We live together in this community. People like Pat will be released back to this community and trying to figure out how to best support each other instead of labeling and stigmatizing. Trying to figure out how to integrate and not isolate is going to be better for all of us. So look for Pat coming out in 2016, I hope. So Pat did get released in June from Bridgewater. A friend of his picked him up and helped him get his stuff and accompanied him to Western Mass and to reunite with his daughter. He came to my house and visited and stayed with his daughter for a little while till he was able to get into a shelter. Of course, he was really excited to be out. And he was doing everything he was supposed to do, you know, reporting to the police. He was doing job training, doing whatever programs he needed to do, and just enjoying being able to walk wherever he wanted or take the bus where he wanted or be outside and set his own schedule. He was out for about 4 or 5 weeks when the police came and arrested him. They said that he was wanted in Texas. Earlier in the show, you may have heard that. So he did 1.5 years for the crime that he had committed, and then, and that was in Massachusetts, but then because he was living in Texas for part of the 9 months that he was abusing his stepsons, when he was about to get released in Massachusetts in like 2002, 2003, maybe it was 2004, the state of Texas said, we're going to bring charges against you if Massachusetts releases you. So that was when he said, well, I'd rather stay in Massachusetts and go to Bridgewater than go to Texas. And so that was kind of how he ended up doing so many years in Bridgewater, like 12 or 13 years in Bridgewater. And then he didn't file for his release from Bridgewater until the state of Texas said they had dismissed the charges against him. And that's kind of what led to him being released this summer. Anyway, so the police arrested him and said he was wanted in Texas and that the state of Texas was indeed going to bring charges against him. So he got shipped to Texas in the van, handcuffs and shackles for 4 days. He said they slept in the van, no shower, no bed at night. It was pretty painful physically, but the emotional pain was even worse. He felt like he was doing everything he was supposed to do, and then now this. And he said the worst part of it was that it was all over the news. Fugitive from Texas wanted for sex crimes. And nowhere in the articles did it say that it was a 15-year-old case that he had already been incarcerated 14 years for. And, like, fugitive? I mean, he's been under state control for the last 14 years. And he wasn't from Texas. He's been living in Eastern Mass in jail for 14 years, and they call him a fugitive from Texas. Anyway, so as you can imagine, he felt pretty crushed and also to be taken away from his daughter, who he had been reconnecting with, his daughter and her husband and family. So now he's in Texas, in a county jail in Texas. But the most difficult part is just trying to not feel bad about himself and the changes he's made. He says, I'm doing my best to keep my mind or spirit from being broken. He was supposed to have a status hearing in September, but it got continued till November. And his lawyer still hasn't talked to him, this public defender from Texas. He says,
I truly hope and pray that this nightmare is over with soon, even though I know that ultimately my choices and behavior 14 or 15 years ago are at fault and are my responsibility. I also feel that all the time I did serve in Massachusetts should be sufficient. How much more can one person pay for past transgressions? I don't ever want to become a bitter, angry person, so I focus on positives and try to be the person that is caring and not let this negatively affect my humanity. It's been some of the darkest days of my life, too. It is a struggle to maintain my positive self-image, but my family and friends like you refocus me and remind me that I am a good person, I am a new person, and I am worthy of love, acceptance, forgiveness, a second chance, etc. Well, the story goes on.
And Pat is still in Texas awaiting trial, whatever is going to happen. You've been listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! Coming up at 5 o'clock today and every weekday. And you can listen to archived editions online at weatherbeer.com/out there.